Hello and welcome. Now, I want to preface this with one quick thing. So, does anyone live here in Utah? Yeah? Yes, of course. Yes. I do too. So I do some comedy sports. Have you heard of comedy sports? Comedy. So I do comedy sports, and this is not a selfish promotion, I promise. It's relevant to what we're talking about today. So oftentimes, the best shows that we have are for the very smallest crowds. It's a lot more intimate, and it's a lot more individual contribution. So you're part of the lucky few that get to have a very intimate session today. So we're really looking forward to it. I'm grateful to be here with Landon, to hear on a topic that I'm not terribly familiar with, so I'm looking forward to learning all with you as well. Reading from the overview, just to remind us what we got ourselves into today, the stories in Mormonism contain a repository of wisdom, but there are also psychological forces behind them that influence how Mormons experience spirituality. When we understand the symbolism of these stories as a model of our inner experiences, then we can understand how they affect our lives. This presentation links the symbolism found in the Book of Mormon to the process of coming to selfhood or self-realization. And I'll hand it over to you, Landon.
All right. We shut that door. Yeah, the light's glaring from the cars, like right on me. Sorry about that. Thank you. Apparently. Well, maybe leave like.
You don't want to look like we're uninviting.
Can we leave one of the doors open?
Sure, just maybe the one on the left shut it because the light's literally like coming in on me.
Then I'll shut the second one here.
All right, yeah, thank you. Okay, so I'll just start on this one. I think this is it's a fairly deep topic. It's going to require a little bit of foundational work in order to really be able to talk about this on any level that makes any sense at all. And I think it's probably good strategy to start really discussing a topic like this by defining like some terms. Because I don't know that generally people know what the term individuation actually means. And so I think it's really appropriate to probably start just right there. In trying to find a really good way of describing this, what I did is I grew up LDS. I think I'm fundamentally that's the culture that I probably identify with the most. It serves as kind of an antony for me in terms of the, there's always a good and the bad that comes in that. And I understand it, at least from a lived experience, pretty well. And I went back and found I really what I would call a kind of a vignette or a story that I think is very familiar to anyone who's familiar with the culture. And I found this actually in the teachings of Presidents of the Church manual on Joseph Smith, and it's in chapter 24. And it was actually a question that was posed to Brigham Young and a response that he gave. And you'll recognize this as we move into it. And I think this will set the backdrop for really what I'm talking about if I position this next to this term. But basically, it states in there, the question was asked a great many times of Joseph Smith by gentlemen who come to see him and his people. How is it that you can control your people so easily? It appears that they do nothing but what you say. How is it that you can govern them so easily? Said he, I do not govern them at all. The Lord has revealed certain principles from the heavens by which we are to live in these latter days. The time is drawing near when the Lord is going to gather out his people from the wicked, and he is going to cut short his work in righteousness. And the principles which he has revealed, I have taught to the people, and they are trying to live according to them, and they control themselves. And so again, a very familiar concept, I think, within the LDS culture. The concept of individuation is a little bit different than that. It's really a process of differentiating from the collective. It's the development, really, of a psychological individual as distinct from a general developmental psychology. Here's a quote by, and I need to say a little bit right here now. The way I'm presenting this is through a lens of the psychology of Carl Jung, if you're familiar with him at any level. But this is a quote out of Adaptations, Individuation, and Collectivity. It's in the Collective Works, Volume 18. And it states individuation cuts one off from personal conformity and hence from collectivity. That is the guilt which the individuant leaves behind him for the world. That is the guilt he must endeavor to redeem. He must offer a ransom in place of himself, that he must bring forth values which are an equivalent substitute for his absence in the collective personal sphere. Without this production of values, final individuation is immoral, and more than that, suicidal. And so what I'll do is I'm going to move into this process a little bit more. But as we start to do this, we have to understand really what the map of the psyche is within Jungian psychology. Because what it does is it gives us a framework through which to start to understand the symbolism that I think exists within the myths and stories that most of us have grown up with. And so here, up here on the right-hand side of the screen is really a schemata or a depiction of the psyche as conceptualized by Carl Jung. Now, the psyche, really what that does is it represents the totality of psychological processes. So there are aspects of this, and you can see that there's this line through the middle where it states the self. Above that is what would be considered consciousness. And within conscious awareness, there's really rests this idea of the ego. And I'll talk about that here in a second. But the psyche is something that encapsulates all of this. It's all consciousness and unconsciousness. In a lot of the English literature, specifically some of the more ancient literature, the psyche is referred to as the soul. And the psyche is really the subject of a lot of scientific study in the context of psychology. Now, if you read the bio, I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and this is really an aspect of psychology that really gets kind of a footnote in your training. But I think it provides a lot of value in terms of one's religious experience. When you get over here to the top, you get what's called, what Jung had called the ego, and he was like a kind of a colleague, protege of Freud, and adopted a lot of his framework for understanding things, but really had his own way of understanding that. The ego is overall, the ego is kind of the starting point for everything. It's the complex, it's a field of consciousness. It's really what an individual knows about themselves. Now, what's really interesting about the ego is that the way people know themselves is usually in terms of good things, and that'll come into importance here in a minute. But they don't think of their flaws or some of their weaknesses as aspects of themselves, mostly error that they don't want to consciously always recognize. And through the development of our development, a lot of those things are kind of socialized out of us. If you live in a culture that's really geared towards kind of perfectionism in terms of a behavioral code, a lot of the aspects of yourself that might not be considered within the predominant culture as positive become kind of repressed or pushed into the unconscious to some respect and out of view. The quote here, I think actually I'll read this. It says, anyone, this is again out of the Undiscovered Self and the collective works of Carl Jung, anyone who has any ego consciousness at all takes it for granted that he knows himself. But the ego knows only its own contents, not the unconscious and its contents. People measure their self-knowledge by what the average person in their social environment knows of himself, but not by the real psychic facts, which are for the most part hidden from them. In this respect, the psyche behaves like the body, whose physiological and anatomical structure the average person knows very, very too little. In this domain of psychology, the goal is really maximum ego development. It's a development of yourself within that. So what that brings us to is I'm not going to probably go through all the elements here, but I'll talk about the ones that are kind of important. If we come down here to the shadow, now the shadow is considered an archetype. Archetypes are these kind of a priori forms or structures that kind of exist that we live our lives within in some sense. We're not always fully in recognition of what they am. They have kind of a bipolar a nature to them. There's like a good and a bad associated with them. There's a dynamism. There's really what's considered like transformational archetypes, and then there's personified archetypes. A personified archetype might be the archetype of a mother or a father or the wise old man or something along those lines. A transformational archetype would be something along the lines of the shadow. So the shadow in Jungian psychology is really an aspect of oneself that you are not aware of. But there's another part to it. You also don't have access to it. So you're not only not aware of this part of you, but you're also in a position to where you don't have an ability to really get at that. Now, in terms of the development of the ego and the totality of the self, which we'll talk about in a minute, there's mechanisms of reaching it that I won't go into in this lecture. But for the purposes of this, one aspect of the shadow is that we often will have a tendency to project it out onto things, and so. This is in psychology called the projection hypothesis, is that there's certain behavioral dispositions, temperaments, there are beliefs and attitudes, there might be prejudices that we might have, that we have a tendency to project out onto the world in some way. The other aspect of this is that we're usually in denial that these things are actually a part of us in some sense. So one example of this is that I, as I mentioned, I'm a psychologist, so I'm going to kind of use a modified example. I remember I had an individual. I do forensic psychology. So in the context of forensic psychology, I'm usually asked to answer questions for a court, is really what I'm designed, what I have to do in the majority of the work that I do. But I had one particular case, and it's kind of a modification of it, but where the individual found his ex-spouse to be very exploitative, very manipulative, somewhat sociopathic was the way it was described. She was an employer, and there was a lot of people who had really had to work under her in terms of maybe this archetypal structure of what you find in work environments, which might be a master-slave type of relationship that can exist. And so there would be lots of opportunities for exploitation, and part of doing this, there's a need to investigate very thoroughly an individual's life. And I discovered that she was liked by past employees, by current employees, her family. Even though there was friction that can kind of exist, there was really no concerns that were brought up along that nature. But then I discovered in him something. And what I had discovered in him is that he had had an extramarital affair with a woman who was not a resident, or she was not legally in the United States. And what he had done is he threatened her that if she ever came after him for any type of support for their child, that he would assure her that she would get deported. And so what was interesting about that, and I carry this quote with me to some degree, and I think this represents the shadow aspect of somebody very well, but also is encapsulated in this quote. And the quote is that we discover in ourselves what others hide from us, and we recognize in others what we hide from ourselves. And that really represents that dynamism, that bipolar aspect of this archetype of the shadow. The shadow isn't always negative things. They also encapsulate or include positive aspects that people don't recognize in themselves, and as a result of that, they don't necessarily realize or integrate into who they are. Other part of this that's important to consider is that on a collective level, because there's this collective unconscious that exists within this map of the psyche, there is the risk of an entire group projecting their shadow out onto somebody else. And when that happens, it can become a very terrifying thing to witness. And we've seen that in history, like Nazi Germany would be a really good example of where there was a collective projection of a shadow onto another group. It was where do we find evil? Evil is found not within us, but outside of us in some sense of the word. The other aspect of this is the self. Now, the self, in Jungian psychology, there's actually two centers of authority. And I don't know that that really exists in any other form of psychology. So what you have is the center of consciousness. You have the ego. It's what you know. But we have at the center also of all consciousness and unconsciousness what would be considered the self. And this quote really, I think, encapsulates it pretty well, so I'll read it. It says, "The ego stands to the self as the moved to the mover, or as the object to the subject, because the determining factors which radiate out of the self surround the ego on all sides and are therefore supraordinate to it. The self, like the unconscious, is an a priori existent out of which the ego evolves." So what you have is you have the ego that will develop out of this great, out of the womb of the self is really what happens. They if you look at a Venn diagram, they contain parts of each other, but the self is something that completely encapsulates the entire ego. And it really is a higher authority. It's if the ego is the person of what they know, the subject, the self would be the object that the person has some form of a relationship to. If the self is the move, or the self is the mover, the ego would be the moved in this relationship. There's actually a relationship or a dynamism that exists between those two. An individual might describe this, because I'm going to get into some very specific details around how this operates. But an individual who has integrated aspects of the self, the unconscious aspects of the self, not only recognizes that they're that they're loving, for example, which might be something that we might want to associate with our ego, but they also recognize their potential to hate as well. They might not only see themselves as like socially responsible, but they would also understand that they are or the potentiality for selfishness in their life. They might not just see themselves as energetic and industrious, but they could also find themselves to be lazy, and they recognize that that's also another potentiality or aspect. So an individual who's fully aware of themselves and who recognizes that will integrate these aspects of the shadow, be they good or bad or whatever they is, into who they are. A self-realized person doesn't really overlook any aspect of this. They recognize that the potentiality of all human behavior and dispositions are really within them as well. And that has implications in other areas that I can talk about. But there's also, because of this, because there's so much we hide from ourselves, right, there's also this looming like instinct that we understand that we are subject to some sort of higher authority, and that authority can very much exist within ourselves in some way. And we need to try to be as conscious of what that is as we possibly can. There's a concept called participation mystique, and this is a term that Jung had borrowed. And and really describes what would be considered the level of differentiation between the ego, which is the center of conscious awareness, and the self, which also encapsulates the unconscious aspects of ourselves that have a tendency to, in certain cases, consume us and overcome us in a very real sense. Conscious identification or the unconscious identification is a person who's really undifferentiated from that. If we look back in history, and this is again, I'll read this quote, the further we go back in history, the more we see personality disappearing beneath the wrappings of collectivity. And if we go back to primitive psychology, we find absolutely no trace of the concept of an individual. Instead of individuality, we find only collective relationships, or what Levi-Bruhl calls participation mystique. This in primitive man might have looked like something where everything within the environment's an extension of them or related to them in some very direct way through a form of magical thinking. It might be that a natural catastrophe, a volcano or a tornado or some a natural event is somehow related to the ritual practices or the gods in terms of their own behavior and there's a lack of differentiation from that. In modern man, we still find this to exist. And really, it exists mostly in the context of our relationships. We can find relationships to be really extensions of who we are, and not necessarily objects that are different and distinct from our subjective selves in some way. Thing that we're really probably mostly interested in here in terms of this lecture, at least as far as the agenda is concerned, is we're interested more in what is the relationship that we might have to authority. When we have kind of a weak ego, an ego that's not terribly resilient and not very differentiated, from, we would say the self, and I say that right now for a moment because I'm going to shift it just a bit, then we have a tendency to project those aspects of ourself, because remember, they're all potentialities, and they're all aspects of who we are, but we have a tendency to project those onto a higher authority than us, and an authority that we view exists somehow outside of ourselves. That provides some form of a sure foundation or some sort of organization to the chaos of our life or some sort of authoritarian figure to be able to provide us a direction or an idea of how we should live our lives. As a society in totality, we can do that as well. We put that onto presidents and Congress. We can put that onto religions as something that can offer that sense of stability. And in a real sense, we can get what would be considered the creation of a god. So this depiction, I modified this, but this comes out of Ettinger's book, The Ego and the Archetype. And what he describes in this is that where there's some degree of stability in the collective, not the individual, but the collective, because that's what we're talking about here. And I want to back up a little bit. Each one of us is influenced to some degree by the collective in some way, and that's where the archetypes come into play. But when there's stability in the collective, the vast majority of individuals within that will share something. They'll share really what would be a common myth or a common belief system. You know, they'll share a set of rituals. In some sense. And what they're doing in this, you look at this here, is if we look down at the bottom, that full dark circle is really the archetype of the self that is being projected onto some religious authority in some sense. I lost my training of thought. It's being projected on some religious authority, and that religious authority is really something that represents an aspect of the collective group in some way. It represents the belief system. It represents the attitudes. It might represent the rules and contingencies under which the collective live their lives. And there's value to this. The value is that it provides a shared ethic. It provides a degree of security in a collective community where you wouldn't have that otherwise. There's a lot more that can be accomplished in a collective than there can be for an individual. And really what you get is that you get what would be called the image of God. And the image of God needs to be distinguished between itself and God in some sense. So we're not talking about like a metaphysical God. We're talking about a God that would exist more through like a Kantian philosophy. Kant would look at that there really is no such thing as metaphysics. we can only really know up until the limits of our senses in some way. So we can only know so far that we can go into space, or in some sense that we can understand our world. And so we're not really talking here about a metaphysical God the way that it really is understood in terms of maybe our cultural upbringing within Mormonism. We're talking about what would be called the image of God overall. Now, what happens is that this can be something that's very stable, but it has specific defects. It's still very unconscious, this image. It's unconscious overall. And it's not recognized as an aspect of our inner psyche. And as a result of that, the community of believers can live in harmony with one another around this image of God. But it's somewhat illusory. It's in relation to a church and individual and really being practiced in a state of, going back to that original slide, of identification with or like a participation mystique. It's not, there's not a differentiation that occurs between the two in terms of the individual and the image of God as it is born out of the self in some way. What happens is that there can be a breakdown, and that's what you get with these kind of shards up at the top. And again, this is a modified image out of that book. But you can get a breakdown of the image of God. And this happens in a couple of different ways. So in one way, the breakdown can occur is it can happen little by little, where that image just happens to change and transform over time. So you can go from when you're a young child, looking at God as someone who provides blessings for good behavior and maybe withdraws blessings for behavior that's not in line with what's desired, which would be a very immature, kind of childish form of God. It can transform to kind of more of a paradoxical God over time. And that can happen. And I think that's the modal way in which it operates from my understanding of this. The second way that this rupture can occur is, I think, more of a unique experience, but it's happened enough that it's been talked about by various people through time. And that is really what Jung had called a complete psychic death, is a term. In Mormonism, they've kind of taken on their own label of it. They call it like a faith crisis, but really what it is within Jungian psychology, it's really a psychic death or a complete ego death. It's a defeat of the ego, where the ego has been encapsulated and overcome by all of the darkness and light of the psyche, or of the greater psyche, which would be the self. Kierkegaard called this despair, is what Kierkegaard called it. Nietzsche called it the death of God, if you've heard that term before. That was what he had called it. And really what this is it's the church loses its capacity to continue to carry this projection of the self in it in some way. It really comes about as a result of an encounter or some sort of experience with reality that clashes with this image that was held in some sense of the word. I use Nietzsche because I fell into him a while back, but he has, I think, really good language to describe this. He calls this he uses it in the parable of the madman, if you're familiar with this. But under the parable of the madman, I'll read you just parts of this because I think it illustrates this experience really quite well. He says, "The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. 'Whither is God?' he cried. 'I will tell you, we have killed him. You and I, all of us, are his murderers. But how did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained the earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually? Backwards, sidewards, forward in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? How shall we comfort ourselves? The murderers of all murderers, what was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood from us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? And again, this is an illustration of how there can be devastating impact of a rupture of the image of God in an individual's life. And where Nietzsche was described really as like the father of nihilism, it was never really intended as like a final state, final resting place to be, where there's a complete loss of all meaning and identity in this life. I think this quote by Martin Luther sums up this very well in terms of what's next. He says that God works by contraries, so that a man feels himself to be lost in the very moment when he is on the point of being saved. When God is about to justify a man, he damns him. Whom he would make alive, he must first kill. God's favor is so communicated in a form of wrath that it seems furthest when it is at hand. Man must first cry out that there is no health in him. He must be consumed with horror. This is the pain of purgatory. In this disturbance, salvation begins. When a man believes himself to be utterly lost, a light breaks. So there's a clinician named Salvador Maddy, who really has discussed really the outcome of this rupture or break in the image of God. And Salvador really talked about that there's really probably about three different ways that this can be experienced, at least in terms of his clinical work. One is in the process of crusaderism. And in the process of crusaderism, there's really a powerful inclination to seek out and dedicate oneself to causes. They don't really necessarily have to have meaning. They're almost like a replacement for what might have existed, where they were projecting a, you know, meaning and some sense of their self into, you know, this image of deity in some sense. Now they're able to fill that container with some other cause. It's more, in my reading of it, a way to avoid or to not really have to face the inevitable loss in that meaning by finding something to replace that with overall. But there really isn't any, it could be anything in a lot of cases. It's almost like one thing is replaced with another without any coherence to it whatsoever. The other is nihilism. Nihilism has become, I think, in our culture, there's an idea that this is an enlightened state of being, but it can also be very destructive. It's an attitude in most cases of that there really is no meaning to anything in this world, that it's all a product of human construction. And there's a cynicism, an attitude of I'm going to burn everything to the ground that's meaningful to anybody to help them be as enlightened as I will be. And that is also a very destructive way of experiencing this. The last one that he talks about, which is really the worst of all, is he would call the vegetative state that people will find themselves in. It's not let's build and be industrious as a way to kind of avoid. It's not let's burn the whole church to the ground. It's really an attitude of apathy. It's a lack of movement. It's going between a state of depression and really not having any motivation for anything in this world. It's really a vegetative state. But again, this is a location on the path in terms of the entire round that one you would hope one would experience as they go through this. There's an existential statement out there that where it's stated that life begins at despair. And this really is the breaking of light in terms of the coming of a new day, so to speak. I think this quote, again, out of the collective works of Jung, I think helps wrap up some of this a little bit, and I'll talk about where this goes next. But the self, in its efforts at self-realization, reaches out beyond the ego personality on all sides. Because its all-encompassing nature, it is brighter and darker than the ego, and accordingly confronts it with problems which it would like to avoid. Either one's moral courage fails, or one's insight, or both, until in the end, end, fate decides. You have become the victim of a decision made over your head or in defiance of the heart. From this, we can see the numinous power of the self, which can hardly be experienced in any other way. For this reason, the experience of the self, the encounter with the self, right, which would be the image of God, right, is always a defeat of the ego. So what you have here is you have an apocalyptic experience that happens, and it's on a psychological level. But what's the anecdote to this? You know, what where does it go, right, in terms of some sort of recovery, redemption of meaning overall? And this answer really is that Jung had written a commentary on the Book of Job, and there's a full analysis of this in the book in a book that's titled An Answer to Job, written by Carl Jung, that's really probably would require a day to go through. But in terms of a synopsis, what you have is you have this God-fearing, you know, righteous man, Job, who is subject to a wager in heaven, and that wager is between Satan and God, that Job will, according to Satan, curse God. That's what he'll do. Now, that wager is really probably more of a factor of like it's a transpersonal archetypal factor associated with the self. It's an aspect of his unconscious. Because the way that we look at this under a Jungian lens is we don't look at the narratives that we read maybe in the Old Testament where we would find the Book of Job as being actual natural events that we could find on a TV screen if we had had those videotaped. We find those as psychological in a sense to where they have psychological, I mean, they're psychological experiences, not naturalistic experiences. So it's not a look outside, it's a look at within in terms of the struggle that you're dealing with when you go into the depths of the unconscious of your soul. And so in this wager in heaven, it sets up an ordeal for Job. And now that ordeal is really created, in a sense, by as a function of the contingencies under which Job lives his life. He's righteous. He's entitled to the blessings of heaven. And that is inherent in the wager, and that is what is withdrawn from him. And the curse, not only does the blessings that he receives from God in heaven, but that is balanced out now with the fact that these curses come from heaven as well, born out of these wagers. Now, what's really difficult, and this can be difficult to understand, is, I'll move into this first. What happens in Job's search for meaning is he's confronted with God at the end of the story, if you remember that. He has a very frightening encounter with the numinous, and in this encounter, what is actually happening is God is revealing himself to him. You know, there is a glimpse into his unconscious that helps redeem Job from this experience in some way. In a very real sense, what's actually happening is God is revealing his shadow side to Job. And since Job participates, because you've got to remember, we're not talking about a metaphysical God in this story. We're talking about the image of God as a representation of our collective psyche. What you have is that you have, since Job participates in God as a ground for his being, Job is actually seeing an aspect of his shadow. And by looking at that or seeing God for what God is, he can actually change God. And that's really part of the message of the story is that God tends to, in the story, have a need to be esteemed by Job, a need to be made conscious. But by being made too conscious, then it levels out that ego and the self in some way where God changes. And that's really what we're dealing with when we're dealing with this next stage. So I'll read this. Without the world, God is not God. God is God only insofar as he knows himself and his self-knowledge is his consciousness of himself in man and man's knowledge of God. So a religious attitude, right? This is Hegel, but a religious attitude, if we were to try to understand this in some sort of psychological sense, is really based on a direct experience with God. And if we look at God as really being analogous or represented symbolically as the self, a religious experience is an encounter with that aspect of our psychology. And that, in essence, is an encounter with the numinous. And that really comes out of a similar ordeal as the ordeal that Job had experienced. It comes out of that dark night of the soul experience. It comes when an individual has all of that kind of projected energy that's being projected into the clouds in some sense fall back on him or her in a way where there is a requirement to develop through that some meaning, some sense of meaning. And I have a quote here I'll read because I think this summarizes it very well. And again, this is out of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, but it states, "Man is indispensable for the completion of creation. That is, in fact, he himself is the second creator of the world, who alone has given to the world its objective existence, without which unheard, unseen, silently eating, giving birth, dying, heads nodding, through hundreds of millions of years, it would have gone on in the profoundest night on and on of being down until some end." And this is a continuation of the quote I gave earlier, but I'll read it after this ... right there. It says, "The individual has no a priori claim to any kind of esteem. He has to be content with whatever esteem flows to him from outside by fitted of the values he creates. Not only has society a right, it also has a duty to condemn the individual if he fails to create equivalent values." And so what's happening here, right? If there is a leveling up of the image of God, okay, and I'll talk about this in terms of a story here in a minute. If there's a leveling up of the image of God into something where, in the story of Job, where there's things that were very valued that were lost, right? Being thrown into the abyss and then arising out of that in some sense with a greater enlightenment of that image or a greater understanding of yourself, right? If there is that going on an individual level, what you have is you have that a few individuals who gain that degree of enlightenment will have a tendency to infect others and lift others up in the same way. And that becomes part of the creation process. In a Jungian sense, very much what the purpose of man and woman is to really perfect that which God has given him or her. It is to become a second world creator, is what it is. And I think that's a very profound thing, because what that does is it leaves for future generations something better than the image that we had before. I want to talk about, in the time that I have left, which is about 15 minutes of time, so I think my timing is actually doing pretty well. I want to talk about a couple of these stories or myths that I think illustrate this process very well. And I think one of those, and I'm going to do it in three different ones that I think can help illustrate this. One is the Garden of Eden. And again, this is a very well-known story in terms of Mormon mythology. But we know that in the garden, God had placed Adam and Eve and had told them not to eat of this fruit of knowledge of good and evil. There was paradise, but there was no real consciousness. And we know that because there couldn't be any knowledge of good and evil. So what you have in symbolic terms, if you map this onto that schemata of the psyche, is that you have really the garden with God as representing the self, and you have Adam and Eve as representative of the ego in that. And they're undifferentiated. They're born within it, but they're not differentiated from it. They're living a life that's very unconscious. but there's an opportunity here for them to gain some degree of consciousness. And that consciousness comes, what I find to be very interesting, is it comes in the form of a crime against God, is what it comes. It comes from breaking that commandment. And in breaking that commandment, what you you get is that you get the emergence, the very first emergence of consciousness that we have in our mythology. There's Edinger talks about in his book, The Ego and the Archetype, he talks about a Gnostic sect called the Ophites. Now, the Ophites really looked at the story to be very different. They looked at the serpent really as representing this factor or principle that really ultimately freed Adam and Eve from the bondage that they existed in the Garden of Eden. In a very real sense, the serpent was what was worshipped, and the serpent was worshipped really as a Christ figure. Is the way the serpent was worshipped. That there was a man had this urge to be self-realized, to become differentiated from God. And Adam and Eve were looked at as being his heroic in this story. And so what you have is you have a decision to make, right? And the decision, I think, is a heavy decision. It's what do we value more, right? Do we value the comfort that comes with being identified with the collective image of God, with the community that we're completely undifferentiated from in a lot of respects? Or do we value more consciousness, being aware in some way? And that's what is depicted within that particular story. I think the second one I want to talk about here is really about the death of God. It's the death of Christ. In Mormonism, we don't really talk about the death. The emphasis is always what I remember growing up being is on the resurrection. But inherent in the story of Christianity and in the story of Mormonism is what we would call the death of God. And I think that this has significance in terms of what it means to actually take upon ourselves the body of Christ in some way. So in the story, what you have is that you have an individual in the name of Jesus who receives a call and is reluctant to take this call, if we remember. And what you also have is that you also have this incident where there are clearly predisposing factors that set up the death of Christ, but what the precipitating factor is, the impetus for that, the spark, is really a betrayal. And I think that that has some significance in the story. Betrayal, if you look at like Dante, you know, Dante put those who committed some form of betrayal, and I think based on the story to some degree, really at the level of hell closest to Satan. And this is a far beyond murderers and liars and whoremongers and everything else, but that is where they lied. And so in this betrayal, that precipitates an actual death of God. Now, Christ, I think in the history of really our religious understanding, represents kind of a center point of an era of greater enlightenment. It was a moving from Old Testament mentality or Old Testament contingencies and beliefs, rules, attitudes, assumptions under which we live our lives, which can create a very real dilemma or ordeal for us to a more enlightened one. But through that process, you also have very symbolic in it the literal death of God and a literal transformation of God in the process of that. I know that, like, I joke a little bit. I don't have many friends left in my church. They've all kind of left, and I think it's interesting when you ask them, well, why? It's not really necessarily the content. They're not worried about, like, seer stones or, you know, first vision differences. It's not really what they talk about. It's always the betrayal, right? I feel betrayed. Is really what that conversation is. It's the betrayal that led to what maybe Nietzsche would call the death of God. It's the betrayal that leads to the total ego death, or, and as I mentioned, Kierkegaard earlier, it leads to that despair, falling into that abyss. And again, I find it very appropriate that betrayal is found within the myth itself. The myths, I think, interestingly enough, and Jung saw these, they represent aspects of the collective unconscious. There's archetypal factors within those, archetypal dynamisms that are represented in motifs, and these myths are designed to really help us understand our spiritual journey, understand the pitfalls that come and where we're going as we go through these. And I think, is appropriate. I'm going to talk about one more. I debated whether to talk about this one at all, because I think that my thoughts about this might be way out there, but I'm going to go through it anyways. When I look at Joseph Smith is fascinating, because he's really really encapsulates what I would say would be very representative of the self. It's that antinomy. It's the paradoxical opposites of good and bad. It's, you know, there's so many things. Growing up as a Mormon, I had removed from my level of awareness, right, as I was growing up, about who he was. But I find him to be a subject of study that can provide great enlightenment in terms of who we are. But what you have, I think, in the Book of Mormon is that you have a potential reflection of an operation within Joseph Smith. I want to talk to this. I was actually at one of these talks today, and they referenced this example of Laban being killed. And I want to talk a little bit about that story, because I've always found that story to be really fascinating, especially as it relates to this process of understanding aspects of ourselves that we might not fully recognize, but we project out into the world. But the story of Laban is a well-known story for anyone who's grown up in Mormonism. What you have is that you have Lehi telling Nephi and his brothers, you need to go back and get these brass plates, because they contain the record of, you know, our ancestors, and it's going to be important that we have these on our voyage. And so they go back, and they pull lots or straws or something along those lines, and Laman is actually the one who gets to go ask him for them. And he's driven out and called a robber, and Laban tries to take his life. So you have this just really emotional experience that happens. The next part of the story, they said, well, let's try a different tactic, right? So they go back to their father's house. They get all their silver and gold, and they bring it, and then they end up being robbed by Laban. And they get driven out of this stuff. And then Nephi and his brother, if I remember the story right, get beat by Laman and Lemuel, and there's an intervention that occurs at that level. But Nephi's determined. You know, if you remember the scripture, you know, that God will provide a way, you know, if you just go and do what he's commanded you to do. So he goes and he stumbles upon Laban, who's drunk and at his feet. And this is where I think it gets really interesting at this point, because there's a dialogue that occurs. It's an internal dialogue that happens with Nephi. And the dialogue is along the lines of this. He says in chapter 10 of verse 4, I was constrained by the spirit that I should kill Laban, but I said in my heart, never at any time have I shed the blood of man, and I shrunk and would that I might not slay him. So he's conflicted, is where he's at. And the spirit said to me again, behold, the Lord hath delivered him into thy hands, ye, and also I knew. Okay, so this had to be a very emotional experience. I knew that he had sought to take away mine own life, yea, and he would not hearken unto the commandments of the Lord, and he also had taken away our property. So he had really tried to deprive them of property and life is really what you have. And it came to pass that the Spirit said unto me again, slay him. And the Lord delivered him and has delivered him into thy hands. And then 13, he says, behold, the Lord slayeth the wicked. And again, I look at this as an internal narrative. To bring forth his righteous purposes. And it is better that one man should perish than a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief. Which I think actually happened in the story, right? The nation did perish in unbelief. And then in verse 18, you get, therefore I did obey the voice of the Spirit and took Laban by the hair of the head and smote off his head with a sword. Now, when I read this story, I thought of something that that I found really fascinating. When Jung was doing his doctoral dissertation, he studied a medium, and that was the subject of his doctoral dissertation. Now, my doctoral dissertation was not nearly as fascinating as that, but he studied a medium, and he was curious to understand what is this phenomenon that's happening here with this medium. And if you know what a medium does, a family comes in, you know, they have a loved one who's lost who they want to reconnect with in some way. So the way he describes it is a very emotionally charged experience that was happening. And the medium would say something in this consultation that would occur, would say, who is there, right? And what he observed happening over the course of studying this medium is that there was a strong emotional impetus for there to be certain thoughts, okay? And those thoughts would then agglutinate around an emotion. And I don't think that that's contrary to the way our biology is, our evolutionary biology. Because how often have I had this experience where I'm in a house, I don't really know the house, I just moved in, I hear something in the other room that precipitates some sort of an emotion in me, right? And I'm like, my gosh, what is that? And I agglutinate all these ideas around what that is, and I construct in a very real sense an entity in that other room. And I go in my closet, and I grab my Glock, and I run downstairs to see who's there, and there's nothing to be found, right? And I'm like, okay, it was just in my head. But it was a very real experience. It was a very real interaction that I had. And that is really the process that was derived from that experience. But how is it different, right? Do we do this and are there implications for morality? Do we project out based on a strong emotional experience we have? Do we agglutinate our own thoughts, aspects of ourself, right, that we don't fully recognize exist? Do we attach those to an emotion, and do we develop a God out of that? And do we develop a relationship then with that God over time? There couldn't be a God closer to us, but is a God that is an aspect of us, right? Because what that does is it moves God from the outside to the inside, and it projects him into the clouds. And if we take some sort of commandment from that, because we're participating in a relationship very unconsciously with that God, right? Does that have implications for our morality? Does it have implications in the story of Nephi, who you could say in a very real sense, from a perspective, had very strong emotions, had specific thoughts that were precipitated, who then agglutinated to those emotions, those thoughts, and projected something of himself into the heavens upon which he later then took command from and killed a man while there was various other options. So this is the end of my slides. I want to ask, and we have just a couple minutes left, so I guess there's a possibility to ask a question or two and then we can sum up. Are there any questions about this?
I'm really grateful for your talk because I, from previous presentations, was hearing a lot of people throw around the term archetypes, and I think in a way that was sort of sloppy, so I was really glad to hear the deep Jungian explanation. And what I was hearing in other presentations was the idea that we have this dichotomy between our stories we're hearing, are they real or are they just merely archetypal or symbolic, whereas I was, you know, my little bit of background in Jung was that he thought the archetypes were very real and that they were embedded in not just us, but in reality itself. And so I guess my question to you is, if we're abandoning church and the sort of collective symbols that have come around the church, does that necessarily mean that we're abandoning archetypes? Because I was hearing a lot of people say, you know, I'm leaving the world of church and archetypes and I'm doing my own thing. But it seems to me like those archetypes are always going to be there, no matter where you go.
Yeah, it's a good question. So the question is, do they exist? Yeah, you're not going to be able to. I mean, you got to look back at what these are. I mean, they were born in Platonic forms, right? So when you look at a Platonic form was the image of something like a chair, right? And then there was opinions of the chair, but the form was believed to come from God. And then you look at Kant, right, and his instincts of forms of instincts, or his categories, right, is that there are these a priori forms and structures that we feel that we fill with our sensory perceptive, our sensory information. And what they do is they give us a worldview, is what they do. Jung took that and took it further and said, well, there's a dynamism associated with these. There's an emotional charge, right? When you talk about archetypes, we can talk about all of them, but the one that is superordinate is the self, because it's very dynamic, and it can exist very different for different people, but it can also exist in terms of a collective one as well. So to abandon archetypes, I just don't know that you can, because you don't know they exist. That's also an aspect of them. You don't know that archetypes exist. You discover them in your life. And it's through discovering those archetypes that you are able to start to integrate aspects of yourself into who you are. And that is a process of discovery. It's a process of development, right? And ultimately, in terms of this presentation, is what allows you to participate in the creation. So I just think it's an illusion to believe that you can actually abandon them. It's actually probably consistent with keeping them in the realm of the unknown to believe that you could do that. Yeah. All right. I think that's it in terms of time, but I do appreciate it. You're all
it is. Thank you very much, Lannon.